Good morning, everyone. Thanks for coming out so early for this talk. If you went to the Google party last night, you know it went pretty late. So thanks a lot for coming out. So my talk is entitled "Optimizing a News Website for Speed and Stability," and I actually work in New York City now for a startup called Second Market. But this is all based on work that my colleague Blake Crosby and I did at the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. Blake couldn't be here today, so I'm the only one that's presenting the paper. So, you know, what's this talk really about? We talk about CDNs. I talk a lot about CDNs in the paper, but really it's about, what it comes down to is just, you know, how do you build a large media website, you know, a big one, like the biggest broadcaster in Canada, without spending a whole pile of money and without the site basically crashing every 5 minutes under high load. So just a little bit of background about who I am and who I worked for at Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. If you're not familiar with the CBC, as you might not be if you're from outside North America, it is Canada's national public broadcaster. It is a radio station, a television station, a number of television networks, and of course they also have a web presence, a very, very large website. This is the CBC News homepage, and so you can, on cbc.ca, you get news from around the world, and arts and entertainment news, and weather, and all the sorts of things you might see on a news website, in addition to video streaming, audio streaming, video on demand. So basically any content that CBC produces can be found on cbc.ca. So let me just take you back a little bit to 2005, and I started looking for indicators of what 2005 was like. It seems like it was ages ago, right? I mean, this is Jawad Karim, who's the founder of YouTube. Very, very first video posted to YouTube was in 2005. And actually, when I just Googled for what happened in 2005 in technology. And so this is one of the first things that came up. And if you recognize what's in the background, it's actually the San Diego Zoo, the elephant pavilion, which I highly recommend going to, by the way. It's a really great zoo. It's expensive to get in, but well worth it if you're into zoos. It's really great. And also in 2005, in Canada, the province of British Columbia had an election. Now, British Columbia is the furthest west province in Canada, so they're offset from where the servers are in Ontario by about three time zones. And so in 2005, CBC put up this website, BC Votes 2005, and incredibly, it is still up. So there's a whole other talk about storage management that I would love to give at some point, like how do you manage content and stuff like that when all the journalists want to leave everything up forever. But anyway, this website is still up, and as you can see on the homepage is what people really want to see. You know, they probably, a story would have appeared below. You know, it's obviously broken now because some files got deleted, but you know, it's what people want to know when they come to an election website is what's going on. You know, who's winning the election? What are the results look like? And maybe some news content, a story about, you know, what the polls look, or what the results coming in look like, and who's sort of leading and what have you. So polls closed in British Columbia around 9 p.m. Pacific time, which is about midnight, and almost immediately, you know, 500 internal server error on the site, right? And this went on for the entire site was down for 2 hours, which is awful for an election, obviously, and of course nobody could see any other news stories as well. And so what's the problem here? Why was the site down? It's like 50 requests per second, right? This is insane, like WTF. And you know, you have to think about, it really harkens back to bad architecture and you know, requirements that are kind of misinterpreted and, you know, leaning too heavily into one particular requirement. And that requirement was, you know, the journalists all say, we want the news to appear to the user as quickly as possible. Right, that's the most important. We're a news website. We want to beat our competitors. Get the stories out as soon as you can. As soon as we write them, we want them to appear fresh on the website. So what do the developers do? They say, that's great. We will store all the stories in a database. It happened to be Oracle at the time, but it could have been anything. And then we'll layer on this J2EE web application to render the stories out of the database. And to understand why this is not really a good architecture for a news website, you kind of have to look at what the traffic patterns of news are. There's another talk actually at this time, which I really wanted to go to, which is from the guys at Engadget. And they're talking about, you know, what happens when Apple announces the iPhone 5. You know, how do you deal with that surge of traffic? And that's exactly what a news website deals with. You know, this is February 11th, earlier this year, 2012, and Whitney Houston dies at about 7 p.m. So we're trucking along all day. It's all great. We're doing about, you know, a gigabit per second in traffic. It's a great day. Everybody goes home, and then all of a sudden you have this gigantic wall of traffic, right? 13 and a half gigabits per second just in like a five-minute interval. So this is the sort of crazy surge of traffic that you often have to deal with on a news website. So how do you architect the back end? How do you architect the system to make that viable? You look at even though there's a huge number of people coming to the website, the story itself, the news that people are coming to see, it's actually not updated that often. You know, the journalists, as they're getting facts, as they're getting more information from the field, they'll go into the content management system and update the story with what's known, but it's actually not that much, even for a huge breaking story like the Whitney Houston death. You know, this is the number of story updates per hour, and it's only about five or six, right, at most. And overall, over the lifetime of that story, it's only updated about 20 times, right? So it doesn't make a lot of sense. You know, the design is kind of based on faulty assumptions, just not very good assumptions. And so it really leads to, you know, this architecture just not being viable. To re-render the story every time, you know, when it's not updated that frequently, it's just not a good idea. So what are the actual requirements for a news website in addition to the content freshness, which I touched on before? Well, number one is stability and reliability. Right. It's senseless to talk about basically, I mean, in my perspective, it's senseless to talk about any other facts like content freshness if the entire site is unavailable. If nobody can get to it, it doesn't matter how fresh, how quickly you're publishing that content, nobody can see it. And then, you know, as I mentioned content freshness before, the journalists expect to see their stories appear within a reasonable amount of time when they publish them, when they change them. The third thing is system complexity. We want to try to keep the moving parts on the site as low as possible, the number of moving parts as low as possible, the ease of operating that site as easy as possible, because sometimes, you know, if you do get a huge news event, you might need to do some tuning, you may need to turn off some parts of the site, and you never know when that's going to happen, right? I mean, Whitney Houston passes away, it's 7 p.m., 7, 8 p.m. Eastern time, but something could happen in the middle of the night, you know, like Osama bin Laden, for example, you know, when the SEALs went in and took him out, it was about midnight, right? So you could get a wall of traffic, and you might not have the most senior sysadmins around to touch the various knobs and to tune your site. So you need to be able to make those tuning knobs, you know, to recover in the case of emergency, really, really simple to operate. If you're waking somebody out of bed, if it happens to be a junior SA, and dealing with that. And of course, the fourth thing is cost. You know, you can't keep a whole pile of, you know, like 100 servers or whatever around, sitting around for the moment when you get a giant wall of traffic. And you also don't want to commit yourself to too much bandwidth contracts and things like that for just for, you know, the one or two times a year or whatever that a giant wall of traffic hits your site. So what we actually ended up doing was slimming down the entire site architecture to just an SSI-based website. Now, it's kind of laughable, right? I mean, SSI is very, very primitive, but it's also very fast, and it's also extremely secure from the perspective of, well, if you turn off a number of features in Apache, like being able to execute arbitrary code on the site, which it allows you in the default configuration, you know, there's actually no way that if you don't load the modules into your web server, that people can execute code on the server. So that's what we do, and it also means that anything that gets to the website has to go through a defined workflow, right? Nobody can just publish an entire story onto the website. It has to go through the content management system, and that has also journalistic benefits, right? You know, for legal reasons, in case we're sued or whatever. You know, that information as to who updated what story at what time and what changes they made, that's all in the CMS. So the CMS is where all that logic is in terms of how the journalists make their stories. And then once there's a rendering phase, and that information is just published, you know, as basically server-side include documents to the website. And it also makes it super easy to turn off site features in the case of high traffic, right? As with most websites, there's all this, a lot of personalization stuff, you know, weather widgets, localization, things like that. if the site gets really inundated with traffic and we have to turn those things off, it's very, very easy because it's just, there's a wrapper that wraps the whole story content, and you simply change the wrapper to turn off the features you don't want, and you don't have to republish anything. Immediately, new people that come to the site to see those stories just see the slimmed down version of that. There's more details in the paper. I wanted to show some code here, but I didn't have a lot of time. So, read the paper. It's got some details about how we do that. So down to the meat of what I really wanted to talk about. I mean, of course, we use a CDN, and you can't. And what I wanted to say before talking about the actual CDN tuning parameters and the delivery parameters is, the CDN isn't kind of a replacement for having a stable origin. And so I wanted to sort of illustrate that you have to have a stable origin infrastructure before you can effectively use a CDN. And I talked to some of the folks at Akamai, and they completely agree with that. There's a lot of customers that misuse a CDN and think that it's just a panacea to solve stability problems. No, I mean, your infrastructure has to be solid, and that's when you get the real benefits from the CDN. So let me just talk about some of the delivery parameters and the content, the tuning and stuff like that we did with the CDN. So prior to, we were using a CDN for a very long time, even when the site was on fire, and there were also some problems with tuning of content freshness. The business rules for freshness of the content were extremely complicated, and you would get a lot, sort of the indicator that this was a problem is people would call up the help desk or call my team all the time and say, I need you to purge this story from the cache, from the CDN. And I mean, I'm very opinionated about that. If you have to fulfill customer requests to purge things from the cache, then you're probably doing it wrong. You should never have to do that. It's also a very high priority, right? It's a really panicked situation. There's probably a reason they want you to purge the thing from the cache. Don't do that. Just architect the system so that you never have to do that. And so what we decided to do is from the first principles, we just said, we're going to set a global time to live for all documents on the website, which is about 20 seconds. Which is good enough so that if a journalist updates a story, then within a certain reasonable amount of time, they'll see that story and it will appear to be immediate to them, right? It's good enough. We also heavily leverage the if modified since logic available. So, in a typical request from a CDN to an origin, or I mean even just from a browser to a web server if you're not using a CDN, you get a story, you say HTTP get, and then the origin says HTTP 200 okay, blah, 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 here's the story body, right? It could be a lot of content. If you use if modified since, then what the CDN will do is they'll say, okay, well, if I already have this object in cache on the edge, I will pass on the get request, but I will say if modified since the timestamp that I have in my cache. And the origin, if you have it configured properly, will just say, great, 304 not modified, the story hasn't been changed. And that's it, that's the entirety of that HTTP transaction. Very, very small packet size, right? The CDN says, that's great, I'm just gonna serve what I have to the end user, and you're done. And so you can see how this matches up with the access patterns on the website, right? This is a graph of, I guess I better not move too far. This is a graph of the origin response codes, which kind of bears out what I'm saying. The light blue are the 304 not modified responses to the CDN, and the dark blue are the 200s, where the CDN had to fetch the entire story body. So about a little over two-thirds of the requests for any stories on a given day are 304 not modified, as you might expect from what I talked about before with how often the documents are updated. So you have this global site TTL, then what do you do? Some things are not modified that frequently on a website, like your favicon.ico, maybe some of the header images, maybe some of the JavaScript. So organizing the file system and sort of making entire directories and organizing them by how frequently those things are updated makes it really, really easy to then set those time-to-live rules on the origin. So that's what we did. We said to the developers, put all your JavaScript and CSS and things like this that you're going to change maybe once a week into this directory, put the stuff that's really long-lived into this other directory, and then you simply set those rules per directory, and then you're done. This crazy, override by particular document or whatever. This is just last mile acceleration and origin compression. That's just a fancy word for gzipping. Make sure you're gzipping in both directions, both between your origin and the CDN, and then making sure that the CDN has gzip compression possible to the browser if it can support it. Right. So that reduces bandwidth quite a bit, and it also makes the user experience very fast. We also configure persistent connections with the CDN, so the CDN opens a pile of very, very long-lived connections to avoid the overhead of a three-way TCP handshake, and it simply uses that pipe for, you know, a certain amount of time. It's about 300 seconds. And what we actually do, and when I say appropriate timeouts, you know, on your origin web server, there's a keep alive timeout, and you want to make sure that that keep alive timeout is higher than what's configured at the CDN, so that the CDN is the one that terminates, recycles the pool of persistent connections, and that the origin doesn't kill off those connections before the CDN is done with them. So we actually set the keep alive timeout at the origin to 301 seconds, one more second than what the CDN says its pipe lifetime is. So just overall, some general lessons learned. Keeping the cache rules very simple, because you don't want to have a lot of business logic in there. You don't want to have to manage a lot of that stuff. Just sort of set and forget. Let everybody know what the policy is and how things are organized. Set and forget. As I mentioned before, I didn't talk about this. Keeping the tuning knobs at the origin. You know, when you're using a CDN, there's a lot of features you can tune in the CDN's control panel. You know, having to do with a lot of those features, like how long documents live and cache control headers and all this stuff. What we found is that, especially with CDNs being so large, you know, Akamai, which is, I mean, I haven't mentioned that CBC is an Akamai customer, but, you know, Akamai has 80,000 servers worldwide, and so there's a giant propagation delay if you make a change on the Akamai side for that thing to get staged out through a number of environments before it actually gets out to all 80,000. The more knobs you can keep on your own origin infrastructure, the better it is. So, for example, if we needed to increase the global site TTL to 30 seconds, let's say, in a high traffic situation, we would just need to change that once. Akamai would pick that up on the next set of requests, and it would slowly fan out that way without us having to go through the whole staging process with Akamai, you know, metadata validation and all that. The third thing that I mentioned is, you know, organizing and categorizing the content by how frequently that stuff is, how frequently the objects are changed. And the fourth thing I wanted to mention is, you know, understanding the meaning of TTL. TTL, when you're interacting with the CDN, when you're dealing with web content, doesn't mean the same thing as DNS TTL. You know, in DNS, when the TTL expires, like, that's it. The record is considered to be invalid. You know, it's removed from any DNS servers that are intermediate. When interacting with a CDN, TTL just means the sort of the check interval under which the CDN will check your origin for content. So if you set a TTL of 20 seconds, that just means it tells the CDN to go away for 20 seconds. But after that 20 seconds expires, if there's a new request from the user, it doesn't mean that that object is already evicted from the CDN's cache. It's probably still there. And that was a kind of a misunderstanding that we had. If it's still there, then the CDN will just do that if modified since check, and then if it's still in cache, it'll just serve that object to the end user. So, you know, really understanding what TTL means, and it's not like every other TTL in the world. So just briefly, outcomes. CBC actually runs a very, very small origin infrastructure as a result. For 7 years, from 2003 to 2010, there were only 6 origin web servers. We obviously upgraded them as their warranties expired and things like that, moving from HPX to Linux. And then in 2010, we decided that we wanted a little bit more runway, so we bought 3 more web servers. So actually, the origin is very small, right? This is like, you know, 10, 15K now. It doesn't cost a lot of money to maintain. It doesn't cost a lot of money to replace it. And actually, this whole design, with the way things are, there's quite a bit of runway. The server's running on average, you know, 40% CPU utilization on a daily basis. And that's sort of borne out by, you know, the reason that the CPU utilization is so low is because, well, most of the requests are served by the CDN. And these, I'm just showing a couple of graphs here. Most of the bandwidth and most of the requests are served by the CDN. You know, the origin offload is something like 90% with this mechanism. So that's basically it. That's a very high-level summary of how to keep your news website running smoothly at a minimum of cost. I'll be happy to take any questions if you have any.
I'll ask. So have you thought, or did you implement anything to make the slim down process automatic based on load or anything like that, so you don't have to page a junior sysadmin in the middle of the night to turn the knobs?
Oh, yes, of course. The question was that I was from Brent and asking whether or not we had considered automating in some way the turndown process We have considered that. It's a question of there's a number of knobs that can be changed, and a lot of it depends on, you know, it's a bit of a judgment call, right? I mean, as I mentioned before, there is quite a bit of a runway, and even once you hit that runway, it's a question of should we turn off site features or should we increase the global site TTL? And some of that is discussion with some of the folks, right? Because to turn off some of the site features would require some developers to intervene. But, you know, the change in the global site TTL would just require us to modify some of the parameters in Apache. So, yes, we could automate it, but it's more like it's not just one knob, so it's kind of hard to automate that. Sure. So David Lang asked me if we considered baking out and just generating complete HTML pages instead of using SSI. That was an early architecture of the site. The issue with that is that stories are very long-lived, or the story files are very long-lived. So as I showed you with the BC Votes 2005 site, you know, those stories are still alive. And the look and feel of the site changes quite a bit over time. And you want even old stories that are published 3 or 4 years ago to then take on the sort of new look and feel of the site. And so using SSI enables folks to then change the header files or whatever it is, completely independent of the story body. And as long as this wrapper mechanism is still respected, then those stories just take on the new look and feel. Anything else?
Thank you.
Okay. Thanks.